That's okay. But what I was going to talk about tonight was teacher-student relationships. Thinking that I've thought for a long time it might be an interesting subject to talk about. I was interested in talking about it, but then I think, well, maybe you guys wouldn't be interested because you'd be interested more in, you know, your practice itself. But it seems to come up more and more, this subject of a teacher and teacher-student relationship, and I thought it'd be nice to broach the subject a little bit here. And last week I talked about the three jewels, where we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And in our Theravada tradition, the teachers are considered to be part of the Sangha, kind of a subset of the Sangha. And that differs from some other traditions where the teachers are, sometimes the teachers are seen like as the Buddha, kind of equivalent to the Buddha. And so you take refuge in the Buddha, you're taking refuge in your teacher. In some traditions, like in some Tibetan traditions, the teacher as the guru is a fourth refuge. And they have four refuges rather than three. And so you take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and your guru. But in our tradition, the teacher doesn't have such a special status, but it's just part of subsect of the Sangha. And as a Sangha, but as a Sangha grows, and as our Sangha is growing over the years, the role and responsibility of a teacher, of me particularly, changes and grows also. And some cultures and some people have a great appreciation for student-teacher relationships and the importance of having a relationship with a teacher. And when I was living at the Green Gulch Zen Center, they had a wonderful old tea teacher named Nakamura Sensei, who was, I don't know how old, she was ancient. But I think she was well into her 80s. And I remember once there was a tea ceremony in the meditation hall that she was performing. And I got to sit kind of right next to her, looking at her. And this little old woman was making tea, and I felt like I was in the mountains, you know, in Tang Dynasty China. This old, wise, old elder was kind of making tea in this beautiful way. So she was quite an old woman, but she had a teacher who was even older, who taught her tea. And at some point, her teacher died. And she's already a master tea teacher herself and had many students and grand students and things like that. But when her teacher in Japan died, she promptly went to find another teacher. And the teacher she found for herself was someone who was 50 years younger than her. And probably, you know, she could teach him a few things about tea. But what was important for her was to have someone who she had a relationship to as a teacher, because she valued that so much. And in a sense, you know, I think a spiritual life has no end to it, or spiritual practice has no end. And if you find, or if some people find that a relationship with a teacher supports that spiritual life, I can see that you'd always want to have it. Even when your teachers die, you go and find someone else. And there's a great joy to working with a teacher, and it's been one of my great pleasures in my life to have had teachers and have teachers still. It's also a joy for teachers, I think, or should be a joy, to have students. And for me personally, it's been a chance to, an opportunity to appreciate people a lot. I think that as a teacher, you see the preciousness of people's intention and kind of really the best effort they make for themselves. You see it over and over and over again in a way that probably is very rare in our culture for other people to see. And it's quite phenomenal, you know. I think the role of a teacher is quite a privilege. I do these interviews on retreats, and like this one day sitting we did on Saturday, I had 15 minute interviews with 14 people, and so you're kind of seeing one, you know, kind of they're cycling through, and each person is so different. Each person comes with such a different intention and such a different kind of relationship with the teacher and such a different issues they're bringing up. And to see all that, to see it very deeply, they really present themselves in a deep way, to have that kind of intimacy in 14 people in one day is like, I don't know where else you're going to find it. And it feels like a great, it's a kind of a joy, it's kind of a great privilege. And you never know what's coming. You know, you're sitting there, and especially like, sometimes you're in an interview room where there's a door, and one person comes in and has an interview, and they leave and close the door, and you have no idea what's going to come in next. And it's important, you know, to kind of, and a teacher-student relationship is a, it's a relationship that gets created together. So I don't know who I am as a teacher until I'm presented with a student, or the student shows up. I mean, I don't have a clue who I'm supposed to be so much. And so I'm sitting there, and so it's been pretty, sometimes it's pretty dramatic what happens in interviews. And then the next person comes in, and it's a completely different event. And, you know, it's been a whole series of people, like on the retreat, a whole series of people are coming in really quiet, you know, really quiet and meditative, and, you know, I kind of meet their energy, you know, and quiet and meditative, you know, talk to them. And then usually some guy will walk in, like a lumberjack, and, you know, boom, boom, howdy! You know, so I have to kind of, you know, pull myself together quickly or whatever, and hi! Because I want you to meet that person, right? And then the next person comes in, and, you know, their mother just died. You know, literally. There was someone whose cousin had died half an hour earlier. They came in for interview, or just been told half an hour earlier. So that was, you know, then that's what you meet. And so there's all this stuff. And so it's, there's a lot of preciousness, I feel, in this role. So I think in some ways I understand why it's an archetypical role or a sacred role. And there's all kinds of strange things in being a teacher. One of the odd things is having people come and tell me, oh, what you said, you know, a year ago was so wonderful. And then what did I say? And I can't imagine, they tell me, and I can't imagine ever having said such a thing. And it's said sometimes we have lost the models for student-teacher relationships or relationships of mentoring or of apprenticeship that we used to have in the West. And perhaps because we've lost the models of it, that's why we have a lot of unhealthy student-teacher relationships in spiritual circles in the West, and especially in Eastern religions in the West. And then on Thursday here, I gave, you know, we have these Thursday meetings that are very nice. We have sittings and discussion and talk. And I was talking about the five faculties. And the five faculties are faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So faith was one of them. So I was talking about these, and then someone said something like, if I remember accurately, something like one of the things they valued about coming to this group was they felt that I was kind of teaching the nuts and bolts of meditation. And here I was teaching nuts and bolts, these five different things. But it struck me, because the first one was faith, and I talked about it for some time. It struck me, you know, this person said nuts and bolts. And what I hoped also was that I'm not just imparting nuts and bolts kind of details of technique, but also somehow my own faith and trust and confidence in the practice itself, that somehow that kind of gets transmitted in addition to the nuts and the bolts. And made me think there's actually many ways of being a teacher. And we have all these words that kind of cover some of the meanings. There's an instructor, there's a guide, there's a mentor, a spiritual friend, a supporter, a benefactor, an inspirer, someone who inspires you, a confidant, is that what we say in English? A confidant? Confidant. A prod, someone who prods you. It's a pain in the ass, sometimes. teachers have many different, you know, there's many different kinds of ways of being a teacher. And I think a student-teacher relationship varies at each meeting, not just with each person's different relationship, but I think with each meeting that relationship is different. And it's said in some circles, it's said that it's a student who makes a teacher. One of my main teachers, that's what he'd said, student makes the teacher. And I like that. I think that there's a lot of truth to that statement. that it's the teacher is a role that arises in relationship. And it's the student coming forth with an inquiry, with a question, presenting themselves, that then allows a teacher, creates a teacher's response, or creates a teacher in a sense. And so if someone says, you know, I would like to be, will you be my teacher? Well, I don't know if I will be. That depends on you. You know, if you make me a teacher, you know, I can't make myself a teacher. But then, in a sense, the teacher also makes a student. And it's really a co-arisen roles. A story that I heard my time in the Zen Center in San Francisco was from the time of Suzuki Roshi. And Suzuki Roshi, you know, when you sit in a Zendo, they almost never speak in the meditation hall. And but one day during the meditation in the Zendo, Suzuki Roshi spoke. And he said, if you think I am the teacher, you are wrong. If you think you are the student, that is not right. Sometimes the teacher bows to the disciple. Sometimes the student bows to the teacher. If you want to be a good teacher, you have to be a good student. If you want to be a good student, you have to be a good teacher. And he stopped, and then he got down from his meditation seat, and he took these little sticks that the Zen masters have. And then he went around, and he went to the closest person sitting next to him, and he yelled, "Who is the teacher?" And then he hit him with a stick. And then he went to the next student and said, "Who is the student?" And hit the person. And then he went to continue that for a while until he got coarse or couldn't stay. And then he just went around and hit everybody. Zen masters know how to hit usually so it doesn't hurt. Because they do a lot of hitting in Zendo. They hit people here between the shoulder blade and the spine with all this muscle. And it's actually quite invigorating for those of you who've done it. You know, and you request it because you're really sleepy. You put up your hand and you ask to be hit, and it's kind of like this: you wake up. Anyway, it is weird. We don't do it, so you don't have to worry. But in Zen, they do it. That's quite a story. If you think I'm the teacher, you're wrong. If you think you are the student, that's not right either. Who's the teacher and who's the student? Bam. Really got the point across. In the Theravada tradition, which we're part of, the teacher is called a Kalyanamitta. And a Kalyanamitta literally means a good friend or a spiritual friend or a noble friend. Mitta means friend, and Kalyana usually translated as spiritual. And it's more the sense of a friend. And if there's a spectrum from what a teacher is, from like a friend to, you know, a guru, perhaps who you surrender to, then we're on the Theravada traditions on that side of the spectrum. The teacher is more of a friend, a spiritual friend. A friend and a helper for your own work, because the understanding is that no one can do the work, spiritual work that you have to do, except for yourself. And the teacher can't do it for you. And so you have to do it. And the teacher maybe can help or be a friend in that process. One of the epithets of the Buddha, or titles, was the teacher for those who could be taught. And I like that because it implies that even the Buddha couldn't teach everyone. Jack Kornfield tells a story of going to his teacher in Thailand. And kind of complaining and saying, "You don't seem like a very enlightened teacher." And his teacher saying, "Oh, that's very fortunate for you." And that, you know, what? Why is that? Because if I fit the image of the perfect teacher, you would still be seeking for the Buddha outside yourself. And in the early years of Eastern religions, Buddhism and whatever in America, we had all these great teachers, fantastic teachers, charismatic teachers, trickster teachers, unusual teachers, weird teachers, really great teachers. And maybe it was necessary to get people's attention in the early years. But also having great teachers is kind of blinding, and it creates its own difficulties. And I kind of feel what America needs now, for the next generation, is a whole army of mediocre teachers. So we can kind of get down to our own work. The Buddha said you should check a teacher out carefully. And when asked, you know, how do you check a teacher out? Whether this, you know, guy's, this person is worthwhile to spend time with. It was interesting. What he said was, you can only tell the spiritual qualities or development or maturity or whatever of a person by spending a lot of time with them. You better spend a long time with them and check them out. It's not something you can decide or see even in a single meeting or a single event. And I think that's a really good point. Because the danger is that if you fall in love, you know what like falling in love is like, right? How many times have you fallen in love in your life? You know, just madly head over heels in love, and the next morning or whatever, well. What?
2 days.
Oh, it takes you 2 days. Well, sometimes it's a week or a month or a year, or sometimes it's a lifetime, but after a while you kind of sober up. So it's the same with a teacher. And, you know, it's a relationship. Teaching teachers is a relationship. And as soon as you have a relationship, you have something that's very complex, potentially. And so you have to respect the complexity. So there's many questions, I think, that are important to ask when you get involved with a teacher. And you don't have to be involved with a teacher. There's, you know, in Theravada tradition, it's not imperative to have a teacher. In some traditions of Buddhism, they say you have to have a teacher. And there's many ways of having a teacher. One of the people I feel who was one of my important teachers, I've had many teachers in my time, but one of the people I really admire and really hold up as inspiration, and I never really met. I saw him in a distance. It was Buddhadasa in Thailand. He was an old man by the time I came to his temple. And he would just sit there and under a grove of trees, and I never talked to him. So there's many ways of having a teacher. But in checking out a teacher, I think what's important is to check out both you and the teacher, you in relationship to the teacher. So there's a lot of questions you can ask of yourself. So such questions as, am I attached or attracted to a particular teacher because of their power, because of their showmanship, because they're great entertainers, because of their cleverness or their glamour or their ideas? Or the good vibes I get from being around it. What is it? Can you recognize and identify what is it that attracts you? Or what is it you're attached to? What motivates me to be involved or be in contact with this teacher? Is there fear in that relationship? Or is there love in that relationship? What is going on? Is there a sense of acceptance in the relationship? Especially notice if there's any fear. Is my response to the teacher primarily some kind of physical or energetic excitement? Is it some kind of emotional excitement? Is it intellectual stimulation? Is my response kind of an intuitive resonance? What is it that's going on when you're in the presence or meet a teacher? And a good question to ask is, why should I trust her or him? And is it interesting, or how much can I trust this person? There are some great teachers who are really great teachers who you better not trust for anything. You better just, you know, keep them at the distance. You know, maybe go to their talks and be really inspired, but don't get any closer. And what do you want from a relationship with a teacher? Do you want to be admired? Do you want to be taken care of? Do you want to have a sense of belonging? What do you want? When I went to college, I had a big lesson in how to work with teachers in college, because I was kind of intimidated by my professors. And normally, if you're in a class with a lot of students, it was okay. But I had these English classes where you had to go and had these one-on-one interviews with the teachers and the professor in their office. And that was so frightening for me. And the first time I went to one, it probably was the only time in my life I dissociated. It was years, but it wasn't so many decades later I realized I had dissociated probably. It was really far out. I loved it. But suddenly I was sitting there and the professor was talking to me, asking me questions, and I wasn't there. And I thought, this is really weird. Why is he talking to the wall? Because I wasn't there. He was like looking through me. And I don't even remember what happened. I remember at some point I was out of the office. And then what I learned was I wouldn't go see a professor until I knew what I wanted. And then I'd go, because I'd be grounded and centered, and I knew what I wanted. I'd say, this is what I want, and this is what my questions, and when I finished my questions, I'd leave. And that was what made it possible for me to feel much more at ease in that kind of situation. So knowing what you want. So that's checking yourself out, but there's also checking out the teacher. And one of the basic questions is, do they have anything to offer? And what do they have to offer? A traditional question, which isn't universally applied, but what is the virtue of the teacher? Is a teacher virtuous? Are they teaching virtue? And if so, are they exhibiting the qualities of those kinds of virtue or a moral life at the same time? One of the ways to check out a teacher, one of the, I think, very best ways, if you can get to do it, is to go talk to their wife. And even better, I've noticed, is you talk to their kids. And the kids know. Kids really know what's going on. Sometimes the wife of the husband doesn't know. But I guess I said wife, didn't I, the first time? I'm sorry about that. I should have said wife or husband. Because sometimes spouses are kind of, you know, they're whatever, it's complicated. But kids, you know, kids can see. And then an important question is the teacher accountable to anyone? And or is the teacher not accountable to anybody? It was pointed out in the 60s and 70s when we had all these great, you know, teachers, that it seemed kind of strange because there were these great teachers and they seemed like they were such, you know, fountains of spiritual qualities and wisdom and presence and all these things. But they never hung out with each other. They never kind of went to see each other and talk with each other, and they were so isolated. And there was something strange about that. They weren't accountable to anyone. They had no peers to talk to. And in the Vipassana community that we are part of, there's a lot of peer support as teachers. We have regular meetings. There's yearly meetings and national, international meetings. There's going to be a big international meeting in next July. There's going to be a Wednesday, we have a local meeting. We have three or four times a year, we have local meetings of the teachers around here. And we teach together often. And when you teach together, it's very hard to be on a trip when you have another teacher sitting next to you. It's kind of easy if you're the only person up there. But if you have a teacher next to you, they kind of, you know, hey, cut it out. Who do you think you are? So is the teacher accountable to anyone? Another question I think is important is, does the teacher know how to be a student? And I think you should always be able to be a student. I think when a teacher stops being a student, then it gets to be dangerous. And to be a student, both as a student, as a teacher student, or whatever, I think is to have the capacity and the willingness to change through being open to feedback and to new information. And it's nice. If you guys want to see me be a student, I'm going to be sitting with Joseph and Sharon in January for 10 days. So some of you might be there. So we'll be students together. The roles change. So both teacher and student are roles that are used, I would say, pragmatically, because they have a usefulness in our lives. They're roles, but not identities. You shouldn't be in identification with those roles. This is who I absolutely am. Forever I'm a student, or forever I'm a teacher. In some ways, to recognize, I think it's very important to recognize the illusionary nature of ego identifications. And that recognition is the basis for liberation, for freedom. So even the idea of being a teacher is kind of illusionary, I think, and especially identify with that. That's an illusionary identification. But as roles, they kind of need each other, because you can't be a student without a teacher, I feel, and you can't be a teacher without a student. So they kind of need each other, but a safe teacher, I believe, is a teacher who doesn't need anything from the student. And you should pay attention and see, is a teacher need something here? And there's some things a teacher needs, which maybe is basic common sense. But what does a teacher need here? Do they need anything from the relationship? Or can you walk into the door and have an interview with a teacher and feel the teacher doesn't need anything from you in that situation and just meets you fully, and then when you go, in some sense, lets you go and doesn't try to create something ongoing or hold on to you or whatever? It's interesting that sometimes some students will come to check me out. And the usual thing, usually when people verbally are checking me out, they kind of ask me questions. One of the things they want to know is, have I suffered enough? And because usually it's because they have a tremendous amount of suffering in their life. And it's very, when someone has a lot of suffering, it's very useful to feel that someone else understands them well. And one of the ways to understand someone well is to have gone through it themselves or something similar enough. So they want to find, has this person really suffered enough to really understand me so I can open up to this person and share with this person? And I think it's a useful question. It's a little bit complex. It's a little bit involved, maybe, the answer. But what I've never had anybody ask me is, have I seen beauty enough? Have I seen freedom enough? Have I seen the precious potential within each of us enough? Have I touched that? No one's ever asked me that. But, you know, at least they should ask me that half the time. You know, kind of equal. And I think there's a way in which we tend to identify with our suffering quite a bit. And we tend to kind of to overlook or not be interested in this thing that's most precious within us, kind of the Buddha nature or wholeness. And one of the things that comes with the deepening of spiritual life is you touch that sense of wholeness or that preciousness within yourself. If you see it within yourself, you start seeing it in others. And you see it in others even when they don't see it themselves. And I think that's a very important one of the things that a teacher can offer. And so does a teacher have that kind of eye to kind of, the teacher doesn't have to see you to the bottom of who you are, but something. The teacher sees some potential there in you. I wanted to read. I have this book I brought just to show you called The Guru Papers. I had it in my bookshelf. This is a great book. Maybe it's still a bit difficult to read. It's kind of boring to read. But the subject and the points and the wisdom that's embedded in the book about teachers and authoritarianism is really good. And I think anybody who's concerned about the pitfalls of being involved with a teacher or being a teacher, this book addresses a lot of them. I've been chronically ill for 12 years. Stroke, paralysis, that's what I'm dealing with now. I've gone to rehab programs after rehab program. I may be one of the most rehabilitated people on the face of the earth. I've worked with a lot of people, and I've seen many types and attitudes. People try very hard to help me do my best on my own. They understand the importance of that self-sufficiency, and so do I. They're positive and optimistic. I admire them for their perseverance. My body is broken, but they still work very hard with it. They're very dedicated. I have nothing but respect for them. But I must say this. I have never, ever met someone who sees me as whole. Can you understand this? Can you? No one sees me and helps me see myself as being complete, as is. No one really sees how that's true at the deepest level. Everything else is band-aids, you know. Now I understand that this is what I've got to see for myself, my own wholeness. But when you're talking about what really hurts and about what I'm really not getting from those who are trying to help me, that's it. The feeling of not being seen as whole. So to see someone as whole and complete. And often when a student comes to a teacher, they see themselves as broken. They see there's suffering and there's a problem they want fixed or they're working on. And so people often come to a teacher with a question or a problem or a difficulty that they want to be solved or dealt with. And if the teacher tries to help or tries to solve it without giving the person the idea that they're already okay, I think that there's maybe something wrong there. I think there's two kind of levels maybe almost operating. There's one level and there's a kind of wholeness that's already here. Even when you're really broken, even when there's suffering and problems, there's a kind of a wider wholeness that's already there, an okayness. That you don't have to solve your problems to feel okay. And so if a teacher just simply miraculously is able to help you and solve the problem, maybe they've even done you a disservice sometimes. Of course they should try to help you, but there should be another dimension also, I feel, of what's going on. Maybe it's because of the weather. The speaker system's a little funny today. Is that right? You know, it's normal to have difficulties, isn't it? One of the great lines in Zen is liberation is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. So even our own non-perfection, to be without anxiety about having problems. Gee, you know, I'm a little bit neurotic. So what's new? Someone went to a Zen master and said, I can't cope. And the Zen master said, I can't either. So there's two dangers with a teacher, with a student's relationship to a teacher. One is the danger of inflating the teacher. And this is dangerous for the teacher, too. And this, you know, inevitably happens because inflation happens in almost all social relationships. It happens at work with a boss, you know, it happens, you know, everywhere. As soon as you have people together, should we maybe try without? That's good. Okay. You maybe turn it off, the people are there. It's been working so well until now. And,
it's
okay, maybe we'll talk about it later. Let me finish the talk. If I may. No? You want to talk about the speaker? So inflation, you know, it's almost inevitable, I think. You know, rather than kind of pretend it's not there, you know, just try to be honest about it or see it. One of the nice things, again, about being on these retreats that I teach, residential retreats, is not only do we teach together with the teachers, but we hang out together with the staff, like the cooks and the managers. And so we become kind of like family. And so you kind of, like as family, you kind of see, you know, everybody's stuff, right? And so so the teachers kind of, the staff, you know, has, I don't know, they just, it's hard to stay inflated when you go into the dining room and start joking with the staff or I don't know, take yourself so seriously. But don't, you know, overinflate the teacher. And one of the you know, one of the things I find difficult is when people talk about my qualities and they use the word so in front of whatever qualities they're talking about. So, whatever. It confuses me. I don't know what to say. What am I supposed to, you know, I don't know. What am I supposed to say then? You know, I don't want to say, you know, get off it. But I don't want to say, yeah. I don't know what to say. It's so confusing. Or, you know, to interpret everything the teacher does or says as being wise. It bothers me when I go to some of these other, some places where they have teachers who have this kind of strange behavior, like showing up 12 hours late. They're supposed to give a Dharma talk at 7, and it's this big thing, you know, and so students show up and the teacher, well, he's coming in an hour, and, you know, no, he's coming in, you know, 10, and just wait, he's coming at 11, and no, he's coming, he'll be there soon enough, just wait, and this is waiting. Finally, he shows up like 7 o'clock in the morning. And so they say, oh, he's so enlightened, and he's really giving us this great practice, and he's teaching us, you know, patience, and all my, you know, he knew that all my buttons would be pushed, and, you know, and isn't he wise, you know, in doing that, and, you know, it's the best teacher because of it, you know. It could be, it's possible. But I think it's more likely a teacher is disrespectful. And to be too easy to kind of, to too easily give credit to the teacher that everything they do is perfect, I think. You know, maybe I shouldn't discount that too much. It's a kind of, maybe it's a particular kind of spiritual path to do that, to have that kind of relationship. So maybe I shouldn't be too quick to discount it. Because there are spiritual paths where you kind of surrender to the teacher, to the guru. And we shouldn't criticize certain paths. At certain times, that's a really powerful and effective path. And so maybe that's one way maybe in that system, that's how it works. I don't know. But I find it a little bit odd. Yes?
Wouldn't you need to look at the intent of the teacher? Was he doing it for the student?
Yeah, but you can't get close enough to find out.
Yeah.
So... but, you know, anyway, I make mistakes as a teacher, by the way. I made a mistake this very week, probably just this evening, probably. Talking up here. Anyway, I make mistakes. I felt bad about it a little bit this week because someone came in for an interview with me. And we had a nice talk enough, but the person asked a very simple, basic question, and I could have just answered directly. And I was interested in kind of probing a little bit deeper behind the question. And it was inappropriate in that situation. Sometimes it's very appropriate, and sometimes it's really not what's called for. And I misread the situation. So that's, you know, one problem, inflating a teacher too much. Another problem is being excessively cautious or suspicious of the teacher. So suspicious, you don't even check the teacher out, or give him or her kind of a fair chance to check them out or see what's going on. And I don't know if this is maybe a little bit of a non sequitur, but I was teaching a class at some point mindfulness meditation, and. But it was a class. You know, people paid to go to. It was like, you know, people getting college credit from it and things like that. But people were there because they wanted to, you know, learn about this meditation. And there was one person who was really agitated and nervous and very hard to get sit still and be quiet. Which, you know, it's understandable enough to people like that. But but I felt that there was a lack of respect for just being in a class or being with a teacher. And he would show up often a little bit late. He would usually show up with a huge lunch, and he would sit down, plop down, and start eating this huge amount of meal just before we were supposed to kind of do this meditation together and while I was teaching. And I don't think he got anything from the whole course, really. Very, very little. And in Asia, where there's often a kind of a little bit better sense of what it means to have respect for that kind of situation, the teacher wouldn't have had anything to do with them. Because until you can get your act enough together to show the kind of little bit of deep, decent respect in that situation, you know, that's your spiritual work, is to at least get that far. Forget about learning about meditation. Just get your act enough together so you can be there with some little bit of respect and presence. So in many monasteries in Asia, a lot of people come and stay at the monastery, but a lot of people, it's not suitable for them to do meditation. And so what they do is they work in the kitchen, they work on the grounds, they do a lot of physical work and help out, sometimes for years, as a preparation, kind of getting grounded before they're ready for meditation. And one of the problems that, you know, maybe with the way we offer meditation like this, is we don't have anything else to offer. You know, so it's open doors, anybody comes, and so anybody who wants to try it, tries it out. And there are occasional times where I feel that probably the person's better off doing something else. And if they get close enough to me and ask, you know, and that's why it's useful to maybe have a relationship with a teacher. If there's enough closeness, and I feel enough, I don't know what, trust or something, I might tell them, hey, you know, I don't think you should be doing this. But you can't, it's a kind of awkward thing to say sometimes, you know, because the meditation sometimes, that's inflated, you know. And that's dangerous when the meditation's inflated too much, what its value is and what it's supposed to do. So then, to end, one of the points I wanted to make is that it's important to check out a teacher and figure out whether the teacher is, you know, to some degree trustable, or to what degree the teacher is trustable. And once you've kind of done that, I encourage you to take some risks. Because I think most relationships really grow when there's some risk present, and you enter the relationship with and present yourself in some way that maybe is a little bit risky, and you see what happens. And what happens is there some exchange? Is there some development? Is there a relationship that forms that's useful for you? Is there something that you get back and forth that's useful? If it's not useful, then just forget it. Go somewhere else. But if it's useful, then maybe you take a next step or find something else out. But there is a lot of value. There can be a lot of value in having a student-teacher relationship. And I my own spiritual life would have been impossible without it. But it's not essential. So, you know, everybody chooses for themselves and the timing of it and how they do it and all these things. But it involves some taking some risk. And sometimes, yeah, as in therapy, the relationship itself becomes a practice. Maybe not the practice, but a practice. And one of the places where I've grown a lot is not so much what the teacher told me, but the relationship I had, or how I worked with the relationship I had with that teacher. I remember there was one teacher I had who was kind of a jerk. And I told him that at some point, with great love, actually. I have a tremendous love for this person, and I think it's kind of mutual. But, you know, still, the person's a jerk, which maybe that's kind of a coarse, kind of wrong speech, I don't know. But, you know, it's kind of an unusual person, problematic, difficult person to be with. But this person had a kind of charisma in my eyes where I kind of felt awkward in their presence. And so I made it my practice to try to be able to meet this, you know, kind of elevated this person, kind of in awe of this person. So it became my practice to be able to meet this person as an equal. And that for a year, around this person, this was the practice, to meet this person as an equal. And that was a very rich practice. It was kind of like growing up, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot can happen in a student-teacher relationship. It's a relationship that has a lot of mystery to it, unknown. I don't really understand it very well myself, what all it involves and its full potential. Possibly no one does, I don't know, but I certainly don't. It isn't like I was given a manual somewhere that tells me how to be a teacher. And one of the things I like about it, being a teacher, is the intuitive, in a sense, creative aspect of it. That I try to be really present And there's a kind of intuitive process and a creative process within me that comes out to respond to the student. And sometimes I'm surprised what comes out of my mouth. It's like, where did that come from? And so I don't really know what's involved even. It's kind of like beyond something that I know anything about at times. But hopefully, so you said, so there's great potential, there's a certain amount of risk, but hopefully there's not a lot of risk. Hopefully we're willing to always kind of be grounded in ourself and find some kind of stability and authority in ourselves in the relationship to the teacher. And I like that the word authority is related to the English word author. So when you author your own life, when you author your own life, then you're your own authority. So how do you author your life? And how do you write your life? How do you create your life? And so when I, my college professors, when I knew what I wanted, and so I was kind of like, I knew what, you know, I was authoring and writing my own life, then I could go and see them and I'd be quite at ease. So there's much less at risk then. So those are various thoughts on the subject. It's a huge subject. And I would have liked to have had some time for discussion and some other things. But maybe if I'm in the mood or seems appropriate, we can continue next week. Or a week is a far away. Things might have changed. And there'll be a new topic up. So tell me, was this interesting?
Yeah.
And besides being interesting, think it was useful?
Yeah.
Was it challenging? Not challenging. Shoot. I'll try better next week. So a few people, that's good enough then. You know, it's supposed to be, that's part of the job of teachers, to be a challenge. What? You're losing me now once we turned it off? Okay. I don't know what happened today. I'm hoping it's just the weather or the electrical fields or so it probably just needs fine-tuning. So thank you all very much.